at the dawn of the day.
So the bottom line here is that we are moving with astonishing speed to change laws and policies based on something that has no basis in scientific fact in a way that is harming women and girls without a discussion. And it's also really important to understand that the critique that this panel is making of the gender identity framework is not coming from the right. Right? This is not a conservative argument. None of us identifies as conservative, right? This is at the left forum. This is a left critique of gender identity politics.
We cry through our city. Their ancient call for bread. Our stomachs are empty. But our hearts are hungry too. Oh, hear the people singing bread and roses.
All right. Good afternoon, and welcome to the Bread and Roses Show on WXOJLP 103.3 FM in Northampton, and streaming live on valleyfreeradio.org. My name is Elliot Tarry, your host for today's presentation, and the voice you heard over our Bread and Roses theme just now was that of Kara Dansky, lawyer, policy analyst, and director of the nonprofit 1,000 Arms. Kara Dansky was speaking at the Left Forum 2016, held at the John Jay College of Criminal Justice, City University of New York, this past May. The Left Forum is the premier platform for leftist thought in the U.S., which brings together intellectuals and activists to share their strategies and vision. That said, what is controversial about this panel is that it dares to question gender theory and transgender politics. Not only controversial in today's era of the politically correct mind police, but also dangerous due to the threats and or acts of violence instigated by trans activists against radical feminists. And yes, that is going on. So it is that today's Bread and Roses show will also lend a platform to radical feminist voices, with first in a series of programs on the issue of female erasure and gender identity theory. But back to this Left Forum 2016 panel, the title of which is Deconstructing Gender Identity Under Male Supremacy, a panel organized by Jennifer Billick, which has been termed a critique of trans ideology from a left perspective. The panel addresses male supremacy as it is perpetuated by gender identity and explores aspects of gender, including the difference between sex and gender, and the conflating of sex and gender, and the erasure of women through control and obfuscation of language, also legal changes regarding gender identity. Today I will feature excerpts of four presenters: Kara Dansky, whose voice you heard at the top of the hour, Kathy Scarborough, Samantha Berg, and Penny White. Now, it's an attorney, a neuroscientist, a linguist, and a mother of an almost transition child. Together, they will offer a critique of current trans ideology and how it is affecting language, law, and culture, as well as individuals, families, and women as a group. And I am grateful to the radio show Joy of Resistance, multicultural feminist radio on the Pacifica affiliate of ours, WBAI in New York City, for selecting and editing these excerpts for radio. Joy of Resistance can be heard every Thursday from 9 to 10 p.m. on WBAI. So the first speaker we will hear is Kathy Scarborough. Ms. Scarborough was active in local women's liberation groups in New York in the 1970s, a member of Red Stockings in the 1980s, associate editor of Meeting Ground and the current editor of Meeting Ground Online, a member of National Women's Liberation and Women's Liberation Front. Kathy Scarborough is also a scientist with a BA in biochemistry and a PhD in physiology, specializing in neuroendocrinology. Kathy will discuss the biological facts of sex and gender and define these categories according to science and feminist and queer theory. So without further ado, Kathy Scarborough, the biological facts of sex and gender.
Pleasure to be here, particularly at the Left Forum, because, of course, women's liberation has been a part of every left insurgency for generations. As a radical feminist, I clearly place myself in the left and feel really happy to be able to address other people so situated. So I'm going to be talking about the biology of sex and gender. And I wanted to start with a quick definition. One of the problems is that sex has at least three meanings. Biological sex has to do with eggs and sperm and reproduction. But sex also refers to the act, so coitus, as we say in science. And it refers to biological differences between members of a species, so the sexes, right? Gender, on the other hand, is best defined as cultural expectations based on sex, including behavioral, how we dress, how we do our hair, etc., and psychological, aggressive, passive, logical, intuitive, things like that. Gender is derived from and depends on sex. The dictates of gender differ between cultures. Many people also use the word gender to mean the perception of an individual's sex. So gender is often used as a synonym for one meaning of sex, and this is where the confusion comes in. Gender activists claim that there are female brains and male brains, and this is nothing more than the same excuse we've heard for millennia, used to keep women from controlling our own bodies, our own money, our own property, voting, governing, getting better paying manual labor jobs, or entering the arts professions, etc. In fact, getting into some science here, most intellectual abilities and behavioral traits are characterized by what is known as a normal curve. These normal curves depict the variation of a particular trait among the population. Contrary to popular belief, the distribution of behavioral traits overlaps greatly for women and men. So, for example, using this normal curve, if we were talking about artistic ability, the way it would work would be like this. Some people would be very good at drawing. Some people could hardly draw a stick figure. But most of us would be somewhere here in the middle. And this is true of both sexes. Similar distributions are formed when you look at athletic ability, verbal ability, spatial ability, musical ability, the love of the color purple or dogs or sparkles or any other human behavioral characteristic that you can name. Indeed, the distribution of math ability according to sex has been studied extensively, and in spite of what some male supremacists have claimed recently about our brains being sexed in this way, male and female distributions for math ability overlap extensively. So to believe trans theory that one can be trapped in a body with a brain of the opposite sex, you have to believe that the brain is sexed. But this controversial theory lacks solid evidence. Several recent books have lambasted the biased research, leading many to conclude that we have the pink and blue brain syndrome. But it doesn't matter how much research and how much argument on the science is occurring. The idea of brain sex persists. Not so long ago, some people argued that brain function differed according to race. Today, that notion would be immediately condemned as racist. One should ask, who benefits from the idea that male and female brains are substantially different from one another? And why isn't this notion being immediately condemned as sexist? All right, so getting into a little bit of biology, biological sex is all about the reproduction of the species, egg and sperm meeting to create a new individual. These gametes are how biologists define sex. Though it's now fashionable to repudiate the binary, when it comes to sex, I'm sorry, we're stuck with just eggs and sperm. There are only two types of gametes, and there are no intermediate forms. Gonads, ovaries, and testes, and gametes are never biologically mismatched because the gamete is dependent on the gonad for its maturation. So, this means there are no examples of human beings born with an ovary that produces sperm, or vice versa. There are known conditions, of course, where people don't produce either gamete, and a minuscule percentage of people are born with an amalgam of an ovary and a testis, or neither gonad. But there are no known cases where a human being makes both functional eggs and functional sperm. We make one or the other, or neither. This is material reality. The fact that the male gonad is readily visible makes the assessment of biological sex at birth commonplace and quite reliable. Gonads and gametes are what biologists call primary sex characteristics. Most female human beings also have wombs and vaginas. We're the ones who menstruate and gestate. Menstruation, pregnancy, labor, delivery are not aspects of gender expression. These processes stem from the material reality of having a female body. Pregnancy and labor and delivery take a physical toll and removes women, at least temporarily, from conventional productive forces of the economy. The subordination of women is rooted in the exploitation of the difference of reproductive labor. Women's liberation, therefore, concerns itself with sex. Recognizing reproductive sexual dimorphism, and dimorphism here means just that there are two forms in our species, is not the same as saying that male and female brains and abilities are fundamentally different from each other. It is not elevating the class of female humans because of the importance of childbearing. It is not fighting for an identity as a woman or running away from it. It's recognizing biological reality. Both women and men secrete estrogens and androgens, and these are very important for our physiology. We are more alike than we are different. Correlating these hormones with sex hides important facts. The differences between women and men in hormone secretion have always been overemphasized in our culture. Mm-hmm. Here's a kind of surprising example of how our society's overemphasis on hormonal differences can play out. It's been discovered recently that the fertility of men is dependent on the response to estrogen. Of course, it's well known that male fertility depends on the androgen known as testosterone. But without estrogen action, men are also infertile. Both men and women need androgens and estrogens. We are more alike hormonally than has ever been popularly accepted. As we've seen, both women and men make and respond to both kinds of sex hormones. Therefore, the currently fashionable cross-sex ingestion of these hormones can introduce some gender ambiguity. These pharmaceutical interventions enable a self-representation as man or woman that doesn't have to conform to our chromosomes, to our gonads, or even whether we produce eggs or sperm. However, altering one's gender does not change the biological fact that you've grown an ovary containing eggs or a testis. Surgical interventions take this further, reformulating genitalia to correspond to one's desired gender. But genitalia are only delivery systems. What is being altered is the perception of sex or gender, not biological sex. So we've seen how one can change gender identity without arguing for brain sex. But I want to question the very concept of gender identity as well. Historically, gender or gender expression or the way we dress, the way we wear our hair, groom ourselves, was all about differentiating humanity depending on their sex. Because male power depends on being able to enforce these norms, feminists throughout history have attacked them as discriminatory. Feminists have been long working to minimize gender dictates, to let people express themselves as they wish, whether or not this behavior correlates with their biological sex. Some, like women on this panel, want to abolish the significance of gender entirely. Though this would take a huge social change, it's not impossible. I recently heard a woman speak about how such expectations based on sex were opposed in revolutionary China. This was at a 2013 conference organized by Red Stockings here in New York. This woman grew up for several years unaware that she was a female child because the differences between boys and girls were minimized. They were just children playing with a variety of toys and participating in a variety of activities. They were genderless, and I thought that sounded wonderful. I've never forgotten it. Facebook currently recognizes approximately 56 genders. New categories for gender frame biological women as only one of many genders and actually erases our unique position as a historically oppressed class of people who, like people of color and children, have been sold as a commodity and sexually exploited for centuries. Rather than make up new categories, it makes more sense to think of human behavior on a continuum and independent of sex. If we do that, the concept of either a fixed or changeable gender identity becomes meaningless. So in conclusion, sex is important for the continuation of the human species. Gender is not. Achieving equal power balance between the sexes, ending male supremacy, is necessary for ending the significance of gender. Let's start working together to make that kind of social change that breaks down the gender straitjacket. Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay. That was Kathy Scarborough speaking at the Left Forum 2016 in New York City on the biological facts of sex and gender. Now, our next presenter from this year's Left Forum panel is Samantha Berg. Ms. Berg is a radical feminist journalist with a BA in linguistics, as well as an activist organizer. Samantha Berg's articles have been published in progressive media since 2002, and in recent years she has organized anti-prostitution events in the U.S. and Canada. Samantha will summarize recent transgender linguistic changes and their effect on feminist organizing. Now, here is Samantha Berg.
There is no word to talk about the men who disproportionately harm transgender people. Smurf and turf are not created to shed light on the real problems that trans individuals face, which are significant. These words are used to bully women, to blacklist women, and to shut down women's right to political assembly. Another linguistic device that trans activists use is the prefix cis. Popular transgender advocate Janet Mock wrote a book called Redefining Realness that defines cis as a term for people who are not trans and more likely to identify with the gender that correlates with the sex they were assigned at birth. So cis is supposed to be more neutral than TERF, which is quite obviously just a slur, but it still functions as a cudgel against women. Cis woman confers a power to women that women do not have. While it's true that trans people suffer enormous discrimination, it doesn't logically follow that that makes cis women a privilege. In our misogynistic world, being a woman brings discrimination and disrespect at nearly every social intersection. Being seen as a woman does not provide advantages, resources, or powers by its being. And also, not everybody who is transgender or not transgender is therefore cisgender. The most obvious example of that is lesbians. Lesbians are most definitely not acting in the way expected of women when they romantically love other women. And many other examples are easy to find. There's nothing that the prefix cis accomplishes that the term not trans can accomplish. And that doesn't relegate literally billions of women into a subcategory. And we're already kind of placed in subhuman categories already. We don't need to be subbed anymore. The UK Select Committee offered this definition of gender identity. Gender identity is the gender with which a person associates with. Your gender identity is your gender identity. That's a terrible definition. You don't even need a degree in linguistics to know that that is a horrible, horrible, useless definition. Without some objective foundation for gender identity seems to mainly refer to sex role stereotypes. I have yet to see a definition of gender identity that doesn't either rely on biological facts or sex role stereotypes. But if we're not supposed to use biology, we need to know the criteria, the new criteria, for how we define men and women anymore. What is that criteria? I would love to be able to even critique definitions of gender identity that make sense to me, but they keep shifting, and I can't even find a foundation from which to start. Gender fluid and gender queer are people who identify as being off the binary. They're neither male, they're not female, they're non-binary. Except if gender is a spectrum and not a binary, then everybody is non-binary. Nobody is a pure cartoonish stereotype of the pink box of femininity on one side and the blue box of masculinity on the other side. Penises and vaginas do not determine innate personality traits. Gender fluid and genderqueer people assume themselves to be outside of the pink and blue boxes. But we all live outside the pink and blue boxes. Nobody wants to be put in a box. I'm boxless too. Don't box me either. And so are you, and so are you. You know, gender boxes, they're a bad fit for human beings, and feminists have known this for a very long time and railed against them for a very long time. We need to break the power that gendered stereotypes have in shaping human experiences and stop insisting that men and women must identify with the pink and blue caricatures of human beings. So, cissexism, which is never going to roll off my tongue easily, and transmisogyny. Transmisogyny is committed by cissexes. Sorry, I'm really never just going to get that word right. Too many S's. One key rule of patriarchy is to excuse and obscure male supremacy and the mechanisms that maintain male supremacy. Bonus points if you can blame it on a woman. Accusations of transmisogyny are mostly leveled at women, mostly feminist women, much more than they are ever used to describe the men who commit the real violence that happens to trans people. It takes the blood that men are spilling of transgender blood and smears women's hands with it, but we are not causing this violence. Feminine gender conformity, now being called cis womanhood, does not protect women from being oppressed. For women, gender is most commonly a burdensome, threatening experience. I wish I could count how many times men have told me about prostitution. Oh gosh, I wish I could get paid for having sex. That sounds awesome. Best job ever. As if men bribing poverty-stricken women into sex that they do not want is some privilege that you get for being a woman. Lucky us, huh? But it's no accident that the stereotype of a prostitute is of a hyper-feminized woman, wearing too much makeup, showing too much skin, wearing those stripper heels, as they're called. The highest of the high heels that high heels can get are stripper heels. Prostitutes are the most feminized women of women. And they're the most raped women. And they're the most murdered women of all womankind. Cissexism prevents women from addressing issues like prostitution, which disproportionately and sometimes uniquely affect females. We can no longer say that misogyny experienced by females is a problem. That's exclusionary. We have entered a politics that acknowledges transmisogyny as a problem and misogyny as a privilege women have over transgender people. As writer Sarah Didham has said, I am trying to live as a woman in a patriarchal world. And frankly, that sucks enough on its own without being told that the female body my culture punishes me for is a privilege in itself. Here are some examples of how accusations of transmisogyny are literally making the sexism that happens to women impossible to speak. So, raise your hand if you're a uterus bearer. Coming to that. So the Amherst student newspaper published an article on abortion rights, and they filed it under their new category, uterus bearer's rights. So, this cartoon promotes awareness of abortion, and they thought it was a good idea to replace woman with the term adult uterus people.
Uterus?
Laws restricting abortion are, of course, directed at women because we are women. It's about society trying to control women's bodies because only women can produce new human beings. We can't disconnect the abortion debate from the oppression of women, because the entire debate about abortion only exists because it's based on the resource production that only women can do. The Midwives Alliance of North America, in their 2014 Core Competencies Manual, replaced the words woman and mother with pregnant individual and birthing parent. Birthing parent. So just 2 weeks ago, trans activists were taking to social media to complain about how Mother's Day is transphobic. Oh, it gets worse, women. It gets worse. No longer do women breastfeed. Now we chest feed.
We chest feed.
Chest feeding is being recommended. because breasts are transphobic now. Mind you, men have breasts too. When men get breast cancer, they call it breast cancer. They don't call it chest cancer. The biological term chest encompasses so much more than the mammary glands, formerly known as breasts.
Yeah.
And now about the front hole, formerly known as vagina. Mount Holyoke College, a women's liberal arts college, canceled a performance of Eve Ensler's iconic play, The Vagina Monologues. And here's the quote on why they canceled. It provided an extremely narrow perspective on what it means to be a woman. Writing in the New York Times about the play's cancellation, Eleanor Burkett notes that trans activists are pushing front hole and internal genitalia as alternatives to the word vagina. Look for the new play, The Front Hole Monologues, coming to you soon. These irrational demands are sabotaging feminist fundraisers, and they're canceling performances of feminist plays. This is not fringe stuff. It may have started there, but it's in the New York Times and New York Magazine and The Nation and The Guardian. Yeah. This is our world now.
Right.
Front holes, chest feeding,
right.
Adult uterus person. Capitalism offers an infinite choice between irrelevant choices, but little choice on the important, most life-affecting choices. You can get underarm deodorant in a stick, a spray, a roll-on, a cream, a gel, a powder, and a freaking rock. But your choices for president are Democrat and Republican. Capitalism loves focusing on you, the buyer, you, the individual, you're so special, instead of communities of class, race, and sex, because it loves fragmenting people into ever more marketable demographics. Removing the word woman from the English language, and presumably all languages, if the trans activist goals are to be reached, makes feminism impossible. By denying that women are a definable class, women will remain sexually exploited and will remain oppressed, but now we can't talk about it without being accused of oppressing others. Capitalism loves eternally shifting language games that splinter people into ever more groups. And the 50-plus genders of Facebook really shows that it's impossible to keep up with the lightning-fast pace of these new terms. But a wall covered in mud is still a wall. No matter how much mud you throw at it, still a wall. And a woman with dirt stuffed in her mouth so she can't speak anymore, she's still a woman. Thank you.
Hear, hear. That was Ms. Samantha Berg speaking last May on a panel at the Left Forum, questioning gender ideology. TERF and SWERF, indeed. Front hole and uterus-bearing person. Things have gone way too far. For those unfamiliar, the term TERF, T-E-R-F, is an acronym that stands for Trans Exclusionary Radical Feminist. And it, along with SWERF, or Sex Worker Exclusionary Radical Feminist, are slurs and are used with threats of violence against radical feminists by trans activists. Okay, let's take a break right here. We'll be back.
She put it on the plate. She told the 12 disciples, eat your food for heaven's sake. Cause the Lord was a woman.
The Lord was a woman.
The Lord, she was a woman.
The Lord was a woman.
The Lord was a woman, but she dressed up like a man.
right, cause the Lord was a woman.
The Lord was a woman.
The Lord, she was a woman.
The Lord was a woman.
The Lord was a woman, but she dressed up like a man.
All right, welcome back. You're listening to the Bread and Roses Show on WXOJLP 103.3 FM in Northampton. And you just heard Candy Kane singing The Lord Was a Woman off her album Blues Woman Anthology. And today on the Bread and Roses Show, we are questioning gender theory, transgender ideology, and its effect on feminist goals and struggles for women's lives with excerpts from a panel discussion at this year's Left Forum at City University in New York titled Deconstructing Gender Identity Under Male Supremacy. Before the break, we heard neuroscientist Kathy Scarborough speaking on the biological facts of sex and gender, and linguist Samantha Berg speaking on female erasure by translinguistics. Now, we'll listen to attorney Kara Dansky speak on the legal dimensions of gender ideology. Kara Dansky is director of 1000 Arms, a nonprofit consulting firm working towards fundamental societal transformation. She was formerly special advisor at the New York City Mayor's Office of Criminal Justice, senior counsel at the ACLU for Criminal Justice, senior advisor at the DHS Office for Civil Rights and Civil Liberties, executive director at the Stanford Criminal Justice Center, and much, much more. Kara Dansky will be discussing the legal erasure of women in public places and whether gender identity should be a legally protected category. All right. Now, Kara Dansky.
So we're going to segue and go a little bit into what this looks like within our current legal framework. I'm just going to touch on three topics that have to do with the law and gender identity. One is the legal erasure of women in public places. Two is whether gender identity should be a legally protected category, and if so, how it should be legally protected. And three, how the shifting legal categories have affected our view of statistics and how we count things. So first, the legal erasure of women in public spaces. Laws are changing rapidly, right? Like, we are seeing this everywhere. And they're changing rapidly based on obscure and misunderstood notions of gender identity, which, as both Kathy and Sam have explained, has never been adequately defined and is not commonly understood, and is not grounded in biological reality. We have civil rights laws in place that are designed to protect people on the basis of historical oppression. And those laws protect, generally, people based on race, sex, national origin, and a few other protected categories. Currently, we don't have a legal framework that protects gender identity as a protected category. However, the Department of Education recently issued guidance to schools that receive federal funding, which is essentially all schools, to say that for purposes of sex segregation, whether we're talking about bathrooms or locker rooms or changing rooms, schools are now encouraged to use gender identity to be protected under Title IX, which protects sex. So this is a law, Title IX, that was enacted by Congress for the explicit purpose of protecting women as a category of historically oppressed people. And the Department of Education now defines sex to include gender identity. without having gone through any legal process. When a federal agency is changing its regulations, it's required to go through a process, notice, comment, people have the opportunity to weigh in. None of that happened. The Justice Department has also weighed in recently, both in the context of the North Carolina litigation concerning its recent law, HB 2, and also in issuing its own guidance. The White House itself recently issued a statement saying that for all purposes, sex should be defined to include gender identity. The Justice Department's brief in the North Carolina case is really interesting, and I read it and I pored over it. And it's important to understand that I think most people in this room would agree that the North Carolina law is bad for lots of really important reasons. But one thing that it did was say that people have to use the bathroom that corresponds with biological sex. The Justice Department then weighed in and made a series of factual assertions without citing a single source of support for the notion that sex and gender should be considered the same thing, despite, as Kathy pointed out, they are not as a matter of biology. And it asserted also that gender identity is the sex we think we are internally. Like, just take a minute to think about that. Gender identity is the sex we think we are internally. What does that mean? I literally have no idea. And this is another definition, as Sam pointed out, that it cannot be the definition of gender identity. It doesn't make any sense. The Justice Department also asserted that gender is a component of sex and that female and male brains are different. And it cites zero support for any of those propositions. And this is the United States Department of Justice in a case that's currently being litigated in North Carolina. These legal changes, it's important to understand, are having concrete impacts on women and girls. So just looking at bathrooms and changing rooms, here in Manhattan, there's a group of girls who are on a swim team who are now forced to cram into a single shower with one shower head. This is a group of 18 girls between the ages of 6 and 18 who are required to cram themselves into one family bathroom because one of the girls went into the women's changing room and found a man who said that he had every right to be there on the basis of gender identity. In Chicago recently, an 8-year-old girl was choked and forced into a stall by a man who had been lurking in the bathroom. Now, when I say that, some people are going to say in response, well, is there any reason to think that that man was trans? And the answer is, it doesn't matter, right? Under current laws, and I don't know the law in Chicago, but in New York and in Washington State and in lots of other places, everybody gets to use the bathroom that corresponds with their self-identified gender identity, whatever that is, which means, and you're not allowed to ask them, we all know there are men who lurk in women's rooms and assault women. Like, we know that that happens. But under a law that requires us to use the bathroom that corresponds with biological sex, he has to work really hard to get in there. And women can get him kicked out. But under the new gender identity laws, you can't do anything. Any man can access any women's room and claim, whether he in fact identifies as trans or not, claim gender identity, even though nobody knows what gender identity is. And there's another example of a man in Detroit in a Walmart who offered a teenage girl $20 to pull down her pants when she went into the bathroom. You know, she had to leave and find her mother, and it was awful. So there are so many examples of this, right? Like, those are just a tiny few. However, this is not just about bathrooms. It's really about the legal erasure of women and female-only spaces. So, for example, in Toronto, a man identifying himself as transgender demanded to be able to volunteer at a rape counseling center, despite the fact that the rape counseling center had a policy of only having women serve as counselors. He then proceeded to assault several homeless women in the shelter. Mount Holyoke is the first of the Seven Sisters women-only colleges, right? And these are colleges that were designed to provide spaces for women to get an education because women had been kept out of so many colleges and universities for so many hundreds of years. Mount Holyoke now has an official policy that allows anyone to apply and be admitted on the basis of gender identity. The Women's Sports Foundation, which is an organization whose mission is to advance the lives of girls and women through sport and physical activity, now actively supports organizations that permit biological males to compete as women. The Olympics allows men who self-identify as women to compete in women's sports. And in Michigan, a woman was recently kicked out of a Planet Fitness facility for complaining that there was a man changing in a locker room. So the bottom line here is that we are moving with astonishing speed to change laws and policies based on something that has no basis in scientific fact in a way that is harming women and girls without a discussion. And it's also really important to understand that the critique that this panel is making of the gender identity framework is not coming from the right. Right? This is not a conservative argument. None of us identifies as conservative, right? This is at the left forum. This is a left critique of gender identity politics. And that's so important because in the media today, what we see is that the assumption is that all of the critiques of this are coming from the right and that are based on some sort of Christian moral framework. And that's not where we're coming from. This critique is not heard in the media. Yeah. So should gender identity be legally protected? And if so, how? So the cases that have looked at gender identity have basically done so under two sets of laws. One is a set of statutes that all fall under the Civil Rights Act in one way or another. Title VII protects people from employment discrimination, and Title IX protects women and girls in the education context. Neither protects gender identity as a category, but it could, right? So activists could go to Congress and lobby to get gender identity protected under civil rights laws. I think that's arguable. Let's have the debate. Like, let's have the discussion. And if people are successful in getting gender identity protected under existing civil rights laws as its own category, maybe that's a result we can live with. But today, civil rights laws are being interpreted by many courts, not all, but many courts, to say that gender identity is protected as sex. I think that's wrong because that, again, results in the erasure of women in a legal framework that was designed to protect women and others who have historically been oppressed. The other set of laws that courts are looking at is the Equal Protection Clause of the 14th Amendment, which essentially says that we all have to be treated equally. However, the Equal Protection Clause is not enforced in the same way for every type of discrimination. So the Supreme Court long ago decided that separate is not equal when you're looking at race discrimination, and that race discrimination is just about never okay. Incidentally, these laws are now being used against black people in the affirmative action context, which is a terrible thing. But the point is that race discrimination is almost never okay because race is a social construct invented to oppress people. Sex-based discrimination, however, is usually not okay, but the courts have been willing to allow it because biological sex is grounded in reality. As Kathy's presentation pointed out, there are two biological sexes, and there are sometimes occasions when it's appropriate to separate. If, for example, separation furthers an important government interest, that's the legal ease. And I would submit that protecting the safety of women and girls is an important government interest. So gender identity is an amorphous concept that no one has fully thought through. There's no accepted definition. Its meaning changes regularly, and it is not the same as sex. Therefore, I would say that it is way too soon to be rewriting laws based on it. Also, we do not base civil rights protections on identity. We just don't. Our civil rights legal framework was designed to protect people on the basis of centuries, and in some cases, thousands of years of oppression on the basis of biological sex and on the basis of other categories that are extremely important, but we're not talking about right now. We do not base our civil rights protections on identity. We never have. There's no effective way to enforce that either. If I identify as a child, right? I identify as a child. I don't have to have a job. My parents are required to put me up. They're required to house me, pay for my room and board, and I am protected by child labor laws because I identify as a child. That's absurd, right? We can't do that. And it would also mean that we would have to have millions of sets of civil rights laws designed to protect everybody's self-proclaimed identity. That's not right. We have civil rights laws that are designed to protect people based on historical oppression, not identity. Okay, so in terms of how this is playing out in statistics, there have been numerous examples of people who identify as transgender changing their name, and because they're changing their name, their criminal records don't follow them. So there are a lot of people who have gotten access to leadership positions. There's someone named Allison who was born Dennis and went by Denise and then changed his name to Allison, who was convicted in the 1990s of serially raping his 15-year-old stepdaughter. He served 4 years of a 6-year sentence. I mean, think about that in and of itself. But he got out and legally changed his name to Allison, and then he operated numerous trans activist groups, and this was unknown for decades. So there's a movement in place to create mechanisms so that people who change their names, we can still track their criminal record with them. People have the right to know if people with criminal records are running their organizations. In addition, we're skewing the stats. So in the United States, on average, 3 to 4 women are murdered by men every day in this country. Can I just repeat that? Between 3 and 4 women are murdered by men every day in this country. We don't know that stat because nobody reports on it. It's estimated that a girl or a woman is sexually assaulted or raped by a man once a minute in the United States. When we start messing with sex, we change these statistics. So if a biological male identifies as a female and assaults someone, that means if we start going in this direction, that that assault is going to be classified as an assault by a female against a female. And we're really skewing the stats on this. We're also skewing stats on women's accomplishments. So when a biological male who identifies as a woman gets named Sports Person of the Year or Best Actress or, you know, any number of awards and accomplishments that are awarded to women on the basis of sex, we skew that and we fail to acknowledge women's accomplishments. So my intention here is to point out that there are multiple legal considerations that we have to take as we collectively envision ways to dismantle gender under male supremacy. Many of these legal considerations have specific and concrete impacts on female rights, spaces, and freedoms. Laws are changing rapidly based on this thing called gender identity, which nobody really understands, and for which no one has provided a clear or comprehensive definition. The boundaries of gender are changing all the time. We need to stop. We need to take stock. We need to figure out what we're talking about when we say gender identity before we take a single step further in enacting laws based on it. Thank you.
Okay. That was attorney Kara Dansky on the legal impacts of gender theory on women, saying we as a society are creating legal decisions and laws at breathtaking speed without any basis in reality. I will say this really concerns me, not just from a feminist perspective, but as a society in general. I believe it is our lurching toward madness. And appropriately enough, our final excerpt from the Left Forum panel is by Penny White. Penny White is a caseworker, peer counselor for mentally ill people living in poverty. She has a master's degree in psychology with an emphasis on childhood trauma and a radical feminist freelance writer living in San Francisco. Penny will tell a personal story about how gender identity affected her life and family. Penny White.
Hi, everybody. Thank you for coming. I'm speaking here today as both a born-again radical feminist, very much so, and the mother of a gender non-conforming daughter living under male supremacy. I've always been extremely proud of my daughter. She's always had this bold, wild child personality, this booming voice, and she's always loved insects and reptiles. When she was little, I always had, you know, rubber snakes and rubber lizards in my purse. She wanted nothing to do with princesses and dolls. She had no interest in any of that at all. And I raised her to be proud of her female body. I told her what her vulva was and the different parts of her body, her clitoris and vagina and urethra. And she was very proud of how her body worked. And she was proud of what her body would be able to do when she got what we called the good blood. Yeah, she knew that when she got the good blood, she'd be able to create life in her body. And she thought of this as a kind of superpower. Wow. Yeah. And she was excited when she got the good blood. She was thrilled. She was only 10 years old, and we celebrated, and she was really proud of herself. But that pride did not last. My daughter rapidly began to develop breasts and other curves that drew the terrifying attention of adult men. My bold, adventuresome daughter, who always thought the world was her oyster, began to experience street harassment, catcalls, and sexual threats. There were several instances when she was only 11 years old, and she came home from school shaken because men had shouted things about her body from their cars. There was a family acquaintance who tried to kiss her when he caught her alone. And she didn't tell me about this for months, but would hide in her room when he came over. There was also a devastating comment from a formerly trusted male relative made in front of her a few weeks before she decided to transition. He said he could understand why men commit rape because women are so sexy. Yeah. And it seems everywhere we went, a man felt a need to comment on how my daughter looked, which made her feel extremely self-conscious, uncomfortable, and absolutely unsafe. And my daughter stopped showering. She started wearing baggy clothes and covering her face with her long, tangled hair. She began to hide herself. And it was shortly after her 13th birthday when she told me she was really a boy and couldn't possibly be a girl. And who could blame her? She was a smart, strong, brave young woman, and she saw the writing on the wall. Before puberty, she would joke about the pressures placed on women and girls. And, you know, I kind of jokingly expressed concern before she started middle school that she'd feel pressured to start acting like a Barbie girl. And she kind of laughed at that and put her hand on her hip and rolled her eyes, as she does to me frequently, and said, "Yeah, Mom, I can't wait to get in touch with my inner plastic doll." You know? Yeah. However, that pressure was a lot more overwhelming than a little girl could anticipate. And it was everywhere. At a bus stop near our home that my daughter walked past every day, there's a poster of a teenage girl simulating fellatio on a popsicle. There's a billboard near our home showing a topless teenage girl, her hair covering her breasts and her bare legs spread wide. There was another of a young woman at one of the bus stops with her ass bared, wearing a thong, smiling over her shoulder at the camera. You know, and magazines in the checkout line, fast food commercials, perfume ads, clothing commercials, everywhere. She would see semi-naked women in humiliating poses, poses that no self-respecting man would be caught dead in. So my daughter had a hard time avoiding the conclusion, as it's hard to avoid this conclusion if you're a young woman in this culture, that her primary function is as a sex toy. And if she couldn't accept being a sex toy, she'd have to accept being invisible. And my daughter refused. She decided if that's what a woman was, then she must really be a man. As she began to withdraw into depression, she spent more and more time seeking refuge in online forums. And transgender forums have become extremely popular on social media. And where my daughter connected with other gender nonconforming children or kids was on Tumblr. And with the encouragement of her online teenage peers, she began to bind her breasts and started talking about wanting to take testosterone and said that she wanted to have her breasts cut off. And I was petrified. I was absolutely petrified. I did research and learned that testosterone has actually been proven to cause heart, muscle, and liver disease at a young age. And the thought of her mutilating her perfectly healthy body by getting a medically unnecessary double mastectomy absolutely broke my heart. I mean, when you raise children, you want to protect their bodies. But everything I read or heard about transgender children is if you don't support their gender identity, that they're going to kill themselves, they're going to commit suicide. So I felt that I just had to support this or I was going to harm my child. I didn't feel like I was allowed to express grief or loss or fear or skepticism. And the only other parents I read about or saw on TV were the good parents that were all, you know, encouraging their child's transition and enthusiastic about it. And, you know, I got a lot of support from people for supporting my daughter's gender identity. Everyone said, "Oh, you're such a cool mom for supporting your son." But I was in anguish. I was in absolute misery. But I didn't feel free to express this. And so thinking I was doing the right thing, I took her to a clinic specifically for LGBT kids. The doctor at the clinic, who was very well-meaning, never questioned my 13-year-old child's self-diagnosis that she was transgender, never questioned that. She didn't refer us to a therapist to help us determine if something else might be going on. She just accepted it. And no one at the clinic, none of the counselors, not her doctor, no one encouraged her at all to accept her biological sex, that accepting and embracing her body as it is would actually be more beneficial to her than becoming a lifelong medical patient. And no one questioned the unprovable idea that she was internally male. And to live an authentic life, she'd have to be on hormones and have drastic surgery. I mean, the contradiction in that is absurd. You know, to be authentic, she'd have to be hormones forever and surgically mutilate herself. And another issue I have with this is, how does a teenager back out of that? You know, teenagers have such a deep need for belonging. And my daughter, as a gender nonconforming child, teenager, found belonging in the transgender community. And it became very important to her sense of belonging to say, "Yeah, I'm a boy, I'm transgender." You know, she changed her name, she insisted on male pronouns, she said she was going to transition. And how do you back out of that if your entire peer group, all your sense of belonging is based on this identity that you've claimed at such a vulnerable age? But my daughter did resist the pressure to transition, even though I completely swallowed the transgender party line. I was actually afraid not to. I really was afraid she was going to harm herself or feel like she couldn't turn to me anymore if I didn't support this. But she outgrew this need. As she got older and stronger in herself, she claimed the right to be who she was in her healthy female body, which I am so grateful for. The only boundary I set with her, the only boundary, you know, I could set, I said, no hormones, no surgery, nothing until you're 18. So that gave her the time to outgrow this. But just last month, there was a 14-year-old girl in San Diego, 14, and she had a double mastectomy. And that was celebrated in the paper, like, yay, she's claiming her male identity. She's had a double mastectomy. When my daughter was 14, she still wanted her breasts cut off. 14. She was determined. I'm getting rid of these. Now she just turned 17, and she's no longer expresses any desire to be a man. What she's done is she's claimed her lesbian identity. She's claimed her identity as a lesbian. Yes, yay, yes, yes. And her right to live in a female body as a gender nonconforming lesbian. Yeah. But what was painful and difficult is when she was claiming to be a man, she was referred to a group at this LGBT support center. She was referred to a male support group. Whereas a lesbian support group would have been so much more beneficial to her. And today she's still struggling with some loneliness because she lost her peer group, but she does have a best friend from childhood who's also gender nonconforming lesbian and also went through a period of time where she identified as male. And at age 18, she's able to say, you know, I think I did that because I didn't have any adult female role models who were gender nonconforming. I didn't have that. She really felt like she had to be a boy. I really think we're failing gender nonconforming kids by encouraging them to surgically and chemically alter themselves to conform to society's expectations of how males and females are supposed to behave. What I would love to see happen is for us to let kids know that your biology should never be allowed to place limits on your personality, your sexuality, or your self-expression. And I do worry about gender nonconforming kids becoming lifelong medical patients because of the mainstreaming of transgender ideology. And I want to leave you with the question, why is surgically and hormonally altering children's bodies easier for people to accept than the fact that gender is a form of oppression that harms everyone? That's all. Thank you.
All right. That was mother psychologist and writer Penny White relating her daughter's struggle with male sexual aggression, gender identity, and transitioning, almost. And that's it for this edition of the Bread and Roses Show.
As we come marching at the dawn of the day, all the darkened kitchens, the mill off gray.